Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Julie Seebaugh has accomplished a lot in her 19 years as an award-winning comedy journalist. She's interviewed many great comedians, including Jon Stewart, Wanda Sykes, and the legendary George Carlin. She hosted and produced Hope on Top, a Mitch Hedberg oral history for SiriusXM's Comedy Central channel. Julie is also a filmmaker. She has directed the feature documentary called Too Soon, Comedy After 9/11 for Vice TV. In it, Julie explores the immediate aftermath of one of the nation's darkest times and how we approached laughing again. She joined us from her home in Los Angeles to talk about this powerful film.
The idea actually came from my filmmaking partner, Nick Scown. He's more the filmmaker side of the equation of us working together, where I covered more the journalistic and comedy world side of things. But he had been scheduled to visit film schools in New York in late September of that year. So, you know, when the events of 9/11 happened and he spoke to his friends who lived there and he's like, should I come out? Should I? Yeah. And he ended up going out and, you know, remembers taking photos of the aftermath and going home again with a feeling of overwhelming tragedy. And he got home and the Onion's 9/11 issue was waiting on his doorstep. And he said it was the first time he laughed again. And I was, again, you know, at the University of Missouri at that time, and I was having the Onion print issues delivered to my home. And I remember that same issue too. And I carried it with me as I moved across the country for years. And that was kind of the first thing we bonded on, you know, remembering what it felt like to laugh again was something that bonded us on this project, but it was a universal thing. Mm. Yeah, that's what the movie's about. How can you laugh again in the face of tragedy?
Yeah, exactly. After 9/11, the comedy clubs shut down and there was talk about whether comedy was dead. How did you cover this part of the story in your doc?
I had moved to New York after graduating in January of 2003. And I spent quite a few formative years hanging out in those New York comedy clubs. You know, it's starting out as a burgeoning journalist and getting to know the comedians and the scene and how clubs ran and, you know, learning the business. So by the time it would have been 15 years, you know, after that point in my life, when Nick came to me with the idea for the film, I had forged all these connections. So it was really easy to understand which comics to talk to about that time.
It was a really weird and difficult time, and I thought, how difficult is it going to be for comedy to revive after this?
I didn't know how anybody could be funny again. It was kind of like that song, The Day the Music Died. It felt like the day that comedy died.
David Letterman was the first late-night talk show host to return to the airwaves, and this was less than a week after the attack. How significant was his return to TV?
Everybody watched.
You're watching and you're confused and depressed and irritated and angry and full of grief, and you don't know how to behave and you're not sure what to do, and you don't really, because we've never been through this before.
To see him human, didn't know how to take it. It was a stupid pet trick guy.
We're gonna try and feel our way through this, and we'll just see how it goes.
And it's telling that it was a late night comedy show. And it was also telling that, you know, Dan Rather was the first guest, which was kind of recreating the events in a journalistic, somber, respectful way. And then they brought in comedy with Regis Philbin at the end of the show.
And I don't mean to be silly about this, but you experienced Pearl Harbor, I think, right?
Well, I wasn't there. I wasn't there.
You were on the air then, too, weren't you?
No, I wasn't on the air.
I'm sorry, I thought maybe.
And so just watching the process of Dave, you know, who was the elder spokesman of late night television at that time, go from his speech about, I just don't know, we've never experienced anything like this before, and we're just going to try to move on and do what we can and get things back to normal, which means by the end of it, there's laughter to be had. So him kind of giving this signal to everyone that's like, okay, we can have some other emotions again. We can try to start processing and get things back to normal. And when you're able to laugh, that's sort of a sign that things are getting there.
Mm-hmm. Very well said. On September 27th, 2001, America's finest news source, The Onion, published an issue entirely devoted to the September 11th attacks. What kind of impact did that issue have?
When they decided to return to work after 9/11 with an issue that was all about 9/11, with amazing headlines like God angrily clarifies do not kill rule, or real life turns into bad Jerry Bruckheimer film, hijackers surprised to find themselves in hell.
Yeah.
Every story, every opinion piece, every chart and graph was all about reacting to 9/11 with a mix of, you know, horror, sadness.
It just seemed crazy that we would talk about anything but this horrible tragedy that was happening all around us, that was on everyone's mind. Like, how would you avoid it?
It was almost unbelievable to us that we were doing it, but we had decided that we were gonna do the entire issue about what had happened. We were very, very worried that people would misunderstand what we'd written, that people would think that we were mocking it or acting above it. And that was the last thought on any of our minds. We chose the jokes very carefully, and we discussed everything, and it was like one of the most intense Onion writers' room meetings that there ever was.
It was just this personal sign of, we're all dealing with this. This is how we're gonna do it. A little bit of laughing, a little bit of crying, but we're not going to ignore it.
3 weeks after 9/11, Comedy Central presented the New York Friars Club roast of Hugh Hefner, and the late, great Gilbert Gottfried made quite an impression at this roast. What happened?
I love how it's introduced in the film, because it was the same night that Saturday Night Live came back to the air. And whereas SNL was kind of more somber, and they had, you know, the first responders and Rudolph Giuliani at the beginning, and everything was kind of muted, five blocks away was Gilbert Gottfried getting up and saying,
I have to catch a flight to California. I can't get a direct flight. They said they have to stop at the Empire State Building first.
And the crowd revolts, and, you know, someone shouts out too soon, which, you know, as Gilbert has said in our film and several others, which I thought meant I didn't take a long enough time before the setup and the punchline. So everyone points to that being the moment of, oh, yeah, we can cross a line. It can be too soon. This is when you learn, like, if you don't test the line, then you don't know where it is necessarily. So Gilbert was the one who kind of sacrificed himself for the rest of stand-up comedy.
Mm-hmm. But he did manage to win back the audience, didn't he?
Yes, and this is where the absolutely fantastic 2005 documentary The Aristocrats was forged, which Paul Provenza and Penn Jillette made. It was basically Gilbert got the crowd back by telling an old kind of comedy industry classic joke that really makes no sense, but it's gross, and it's kind of what you determine to do along the way that sort of gives a sense of your style as a comedian. It's sort of a comedy jazz sort of exercise. So Gilbert gave the, you know, industry crowd a taste of that as sort of a penance, get him back, I'm still one of you, come on guys, sort of thing. And he did it, and the show continued, but it was certainly one of the most memorable moments in all of the Comedy Central roast history.
Mm-hmm. There's a very interesting section in your doc about Janine Garofalo. Can you tell us about it and why you thought it was important to include it in your film?
Yeah, so Janine was basically a star, you know, at that time in the comedy and film worlds. And whenever the United States decided to invade Iraq, she was among the voices who picketed against that and went on several news shows and voiced her opinions that it was something we shouldn't be doing. And as a result, this is kind of one of the first times we really started seeing what, I guess, what would be called a cancel culture before terms like this existed. You know, Bill Maher's show was also canceled at that point when he said something that was deemed inappropriate. But basically, the right-wing TV news shows and radio shows, I just kind of went after her and vilified her for that. And there was a lot of flack about her just being a woman in general. There was another part in the film where we covered Air America, but it had to get cut out for time. And she was also, you know, a newscaster on Air America, along with Rachel Maddow, Mark Maron, you know, this was Liz Winstead. You know, this was the early 2003 and 4 in New York City. That was a little bit of context that had to get cut out for time. And she, you know, like Scott Thompson, basically has felt that her career has not recovered since.
You mentioned Liz Winstead, who, of course, is the creator of The Daily Show. What role did Liz and Jon Stewart and the rest of the people on The Daily Show, what role did they play in comedy after 9/11?
The history of The Daily Show was that it was created as more of a entertainment spoof. And after 9/11, and especially with the invasion of Iraq, there were mainstream news outlets that were maybe not digging as deep into the reasons for the invasion as they perhaps should have. And The Daily Show actually became The Daily Show, as we later knew it, at this point, where it started making fun of, you know, news media itself. Rory Albanese, who was producing at the time, and he spoke about how Jon Stewart created the montage of hypocrisy, where you compare one film of a you know, politician, et cetera, saying one thing, and then in the next frame, they're saying something completely opposite.
I want to ask you about The Axis of Evil, the comedy tour, which occurred in 2005. It featured four Middle Eastern comedians. Can you tell us about them?
Yeah, it was, they had actually evolved from a group founded out of the comedy store by owner Mitzi Shore called the Arabian Nights. So this group had already been formed and it just kind of evolved into The Axis of Evil after 9/11 occurred, which took the term, you know, that Bush Jr. had given to the terrorist world that we were against now. And they kind of turned it again, turned a lot of stereotypes and hatred and racism into comedy about their experiences.
It's great to see so many Middle Eastern people coming together in one place voluntarily.
And tried to really show themselves as, we're normal people too. Like, don't believe everything you see on the news, because again, the news media was showing, you know, one side of things about how all Middle Easterners are violent and deadly and want death to America. And they were showing that that's not true. And we can laugh just like anyone else. And when you laugh, you know, that's where the human connection lies.
Mm-hmm. How successful were they in convincing people that they're just like everyone else?
I would say the answer to that lies in sort of their lasting legacy. We showed in the film how there had really not been many Middle Eastern comedians before that time. And in general, comedy was kind of a white man's game. And we were able to show how they actually sort of opened the doors to more diverse talents who saw them achieving, you know, their own special on Comedy Central, their, you know, a world tour that sold out in five countries. You know, as it was said in the film, if they can do it, we can do it too. So we're seeing that today, where comedy is hugely just more diverse than ever.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, what did you learn about yourself, 9/11, and comedy from making this documentary?
There's the obvious, you know, broken records saying of, we have the tragedy plus time equals comedy. We sort of threw in comedy plus time plus tragedy equals healing. And, you know, obviously what that means is, as I've said, if you can laugh in the face of tragedy, it's, you know, part of the steps on the road to healing. But something I also personally learned as someone who's been in the industry for now 19 years, it wasn't so much you can't make jokes about anything. It was the idea that you can't tell people what they can and cannot laugh at. You know, it's just different things appeal to different people, but the art form as a whole, I find to be uniting. And when you're like sitting in that room in the back and I see like all these diverse people from all backgrounds and politics and religion, and they're all like laughing at the same thing in the same moment, it's like, okay, there's a little hope for humanity there.
Yeah, very, very well said. Julie Seebaugh, thank you very much for joining us. Congratulations on Too Soon, Comedy After 9/11. It's a very powerful and very thought-provoking documentary.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Julie Seebaugh is the director and executive producer of the documentary Too Soon, Comedy After 9/11. Find out more at wpr.org/beta.
What happens if you put the Joker, the concept of the Joker, into a real-world environment? What would he be? How would he function?
Coming up, film writer Ian Nathan joins us to talk about one of the most imaginative and innovative directors working today, Christopher Nolan. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.